Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on Air. On tonight's program, we discuss drugs on our streets and consider the dangers of e-cigarettes.
Our concern with e-cigarettes, first and foremost, had been little kids getting into the liquid nicotine. It's flavored bubblegum, it's flavored blueberry, and get sick from it.
Plus, new developments in the practice of emergency medicine.
We have multiple subspecialties in emergency medicine. We have an excellent toxicology service. We have hyperbarics. We have wilderness medicine. We have EMS. We have pediatrics.
And we explore epilepsy in our older adults.
The brain can manifest many different behaviors that are also seizures. So it can be something very subtle, like the inability to talk.
We'll get a checkup from the neck up and hear from our healing muse, all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, how emergency medicine is changing and the new challenges it faces. Plus, epilepsy in the elderly is often misdiagnosed with some serious consequences. We'll learn about what can be done about this. But first, the dangers of e-cigarettes and the new street drugs threatening our kids. There's been much in the news of late about the rise of illegal narcotics such as heroin being trafficked into the United States, and its spread beyond the youth in our inner cities to their comrades in the suburbs. But in addition to this concern, there are always new dangers facing our kids with regard to the use of both legal and illegal drugs. We'll hear with more on this is Michelle Kaliba, Administrative Director of the Upstate New York Poison Center. Welcome, Michelle. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So first of all, how are we doing here in Central New York with the use of illegal heroin? The last time you were in, you indicated that the volume was up at the Poison Center. Tell us about that.
It continues to rise. So just to give you an idea of numbers, we had 250 cases at the end of 2013, and we're already beyond that this year.
And that's overdoses.
And that's overdoses.
In the use of heroin specifically.
In the use of heroin specifically, yes.
Wow. Why do you think there's been this growing increase? What seems to be at the source?
Well, and I think it's somewhat of a perfect storm. We know the availability of prescription drugs has gone down because of the I-STOP measures and because healthcare providers are being more cognizant of writing large prescriptions at one time, large amounts at one time. So it's much more expensive to get those agents on the street. So it's a perfect time for the folks that are distributing the heroin to lower the prices and make it more accessible. In addition, all the synthetic drugs that are out there are less expensive and had to be.
So the point is that things like, initially we talked, I remember, about the relationship of why kids go or why people go to heroin, as it's cheap for one, but they were using, many of them were using prescription painkillers like oxycodone, I mean off-label, they were using
right.
them to get high, and now you're saying, and they would get addicted to them, and so they needed something, because they were addicted, mm-hmm. and with the fact that it's now less available, those drugs are less available, they're turning more and more to heroin.
And heroin is less expensive. Heroin used to be expensive. It's now less expensive.
I won't even begin to ask why that is. But that's still very scary. And I guess the truth is there's still quite an influx of this stuff coming into the country.
From a variety of sources from overseas. It's pretty impressive.
So what are the dangers? I mean, it seems self-evident, but what are the dangers and consequences of this increase? You're saying you're having more calls to the Poison Center. What's happening? Are people dying?
People are overdosing. People are showing up in emergency room, in departments by ambulance and not resuscitate. You know, they're not able to resuscitate them. They are in respiratory arrest. They're comatose. Pretty significant number of people out there with really awful, awful consequences from this. Respiratory depression, CNS depression. They're lethargic. But in addition to that, heroin's a nasty, nasty drug. So people are getting addicted. It's very hard to come off this.
Yeah, I read somewhere a very, very stark statistic
that there were fatal heroin overdoses increased 45% from 2006 to 2010, with over 3,000 deaths reported that year, and obviously we're way above that.
And we're continuing to see it, yeah.
Very, very scary stuff. If you're just joining us, by the way, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Michelle Khalifa from Upstate's New York Poison Center. We're talking about the rise of heroin use, and we're going to talk about some of the new dangers on the street for kids. So what is going on? What are some of the newer things you're seeing? Because you're always on the front lines of this. What about e-cigs or e-cigarettes?
E-cigarettes. So our concern with e-cigarettes, first and foremost, had been little kids getting into the liquid nicotine. It's flavored. It's flavored bubble gum. It's flavored blueberry. So a small child unknowingly could easily pick it up, take it, and overdose with that. And get sick from it. And little kids, they get excessive vomiting. They get their heart rate goes up. They can have seizures. It's pretty horrific. It doesn't take much nicotine to make a child sick. So that was our primary concern. But now we're finding that devices like e-cigs or vaporizers are now being used for organic marijuana use, but as well as for the synthetic stuff. So you get a real strong, concentrated inhalation, and the effects from it are much, much more pronounced than you would expect from taking it any other way.
So apart from this whole notion of the e-cigarettes themselves, which obviously were marketed as a way of quitting smoking for some, I mean, there's still been a lot of concern, even with adults, you know, fully cognizant adults using these e-cigs in terms of all kinds of problems, potential carcinogens in them, and even a gateway to smoking for younger kids,
right.
And they're marketed to younger kids. I mean, there are all kinds of problems around it. But you're saying, in addition, what it's done is develop a whole other pathway of these inhalation devices that are now being used with synthetic marijuana and any number of other...
And organic, you know, regular grown marijuana. And the part of it is that the way the device works, it gives it a very concentrated byproduct. And that's what's being abused. So, you know, somebody's expecting to feel high or feel euphoric, and in fact they start to feel very sick, very paranoid, very aggressive. It's really producing pretty significant and scary symptoms.
And also a thing that strikes me about it is right now there's virtually no regulation of any of these things.
No, I mean, certainly movement, and people are aware. I think our legislators are becoming increasingly more cognizant of the fact that these are problematic. But right now,
It's just kind of the wild west.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Wow. So what else are you seeing on the street of concern?
Well, I'm really concerned, back to the heroin for a minute, that how vulnerable our young people are. I was in a community, it was not in Onondaga County, but I was in a community near Onondaga County recently and heard that people that were distributing or selling heroin were actually giving free samples out to the high school students.
Oh, my God.
Just as a way of luring them into the addiction. So that's the kind of stuff that's getting disconcerting. The other thing that is worrisome is that things are being sold as heroin, but in fact they're not heroin, they're oxycodone. And even worse, things are being sold as oxycodone and it's actually heroin. So there is this pill.
So things are not pure.
Right.
You really don't know what you're getting. You really don't know where it's come from. And obviously, when you're doing something that's illicit, you can't.
There's no regulation.
You
right.
can't report it.
Right.
You can't analyze it.
Right.
You're basically going on faith. And the last time you were here, we were talking about that there was fentanyl-laced heroin that was actually causing deaths. And so now you're saying that there's actually heroin-laced OxyContin?
Yeah, so oxycodone and heroin together being sold. There is a pill that is supposedly in some of the states, we don't have it, I don't believe yet, in New York State, that is a pill form of heroin that is being sold as oxycodone. So the person is thinking they're buying oxycodone, and in fact they're buying heroin. And, you know, is there a distinction? Sure, they're both opioids. Heroin's a little tougher to, much tougher, actually, to actually come off of. So the addiction tends to be a little bit more intense. And the issue with the fentanyl is that fentanyl can produce a longer acting CNS depression. So you could be unresponsive longer. You need higher doses of the antidote. So you just don't know. You think you're getting heroin. You think you're getting oxycodone. In fact, most of the time, the little $10 bags of the heroin are only 25% heroin. They're filled with baking powder and starch and all sorts of other medications. You know, as we say, fentanyl, it could be lidocaine, it could be quinine.
Oh, my goodness.
You don't really know what you're getting.
And so have you seen the results of that in terms of the calls to the poison center? Have you seen, you know, the fact that not just an overdose from heroin, but an overdose from some kind of tampered
Absolutely.
Combination?
We see it all the time. In one of, again, in one of the counties, there were 9 deaths. And when they, when the medical examiner actually did the report, they were not heroin deaths, they were fentanyl deaths. But that individual thought they were abusing heroin.
So what are you seeing in terms of who's coming? What's the demographic now? Because we talked before about the fact that at one point it had moved from the inner city to the suburbs. What is it looking like now?
It's actually that exactly. Just to give an example, a PhD biochemist professor in one of our communities that just overdosed. Just to give you an example of the range. So it's everybody from inner city to rural America to the suburbs.
It cuts across all socioeconomic, education, everything.
I have not been to a single social event where somebody has not come to me and said, off the record, can I tell you about my niece, my nephew, my son, my daughter. I will tell you almost on a weekly basis someone, and it will tell me that they have somebody in their family.
So it sounds almost epidemic.
It does.
So my question to you then is, what can we do about it?
There's been some great initiatives out of the governor's office and the New York State Department of Health. There's a great website that's out there that is addressing concerns around heroin. It's really written in very good, plain language. There are some PSAs that are out there warning people. It's always education. It's education. It's parents being aware of the fact that kids are being exposed to this on their high schools, and they may be unsuspecting that there's heroin being given out as a free sample. I mean, I find that one so disconcerting.
It is. Terribly.
We just have to keep on making people aware and keep and doing this program. It's a wonderful thing because, again, hopefully your listeners are going to say, wow, you know, could heroin really be in my family? We have to start realizing that heroin can be in anybody and everybody's family.
I know at one time, and I remember in my youth, and which is quite a long time ago now, you know, it was always, probably in a public health class or in a health class, some film that showed somebody becoming addicted, and it was almost like it was literally death on the door. I mean, you know, you're going down the road never to return, and it just put the, you know, fear of God into you. And it seems to me today that I don't know whether the education efforts are correctly targeted or kids are just inured to it. They figure nothing can happen to them. It's more part of the culture. I mean, it strikes me that we have a larger issue here, even in terms of, I don't mean to say permissiveness of the culture, but the fact that they don't understand the full ramifications of what it means to become an addict.
And I too remember those films. And when I think of the heroin addict of my day, it was somebody who was emaciated,
right,
and
down
dirty
and out.
And down and out, and there was a needle in their arm, and right. they were dead. I, and in fact, I often will start my lecture that way because most people will remember that. You know, we live in an experimental age, and there's some very, very bright young people out there. But when we look at the demographic of the heroin, it's the 20 to 29 year olds. It's not the younger. It's that.
So it's not going down into middle school at this point.
We're not seeing that. But, you know, anecdotally, we hear about that in the high schools, but it's that 20 to 29 year old. I think the saddest story that I just heard was somebody told me that a family member took heroin for the first time and said, wow, this is the first time I felt good in my life.
Oh, my goodness.
So I think we have a generation of people that are self-medicating. There's a larger issue here. What's making people want
that's
that euphoric
point.
State? Yeah. And that's what we need to get to. We're not doing that right now because the issue is so big. The acuteness is so big. We're addressing that, but we do need to
just trying to stem the tide at this point.
We need to drill down what's actually causing people to need that euphoric state. What's so not okay about their life?
Well, the world is pretty troubled.
Right.
And as you look everywhere, the world is troubled, and so many young people in that age range, many of whom couldn't get jobs.
Right.
and would end up doing things that weren't part of their dream. I mean, you could probably paint a picture, you know, culturally as to what might contribute. Mm-hmm. But clearly the answer has to be education. And somehow, you know, there have been more. I've seen more ads that are trying to, you know, hit that group. And I guess we just have to keep fighting the good fight.
Absolutely. And be vigilant. Parents need to look for paraphernalia around the house and ask questions.
Well, thanks so much for coming in. Such important information. Let's hope that we can at least try to stem this tide. My guest has been Michelle Kaliva. She's Administrative Director of the Upstate New York Poison Center. Once again, thanks for coming in. I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Next, in a world with global epidemics and extreme natural disasters, how emergency medicine is changing and the new challenges it faces. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Critically ill or seriously injured patients need state-of-the-art diagnostic services and expert care. Care that can be accessed 24/7 at the emergency department at Upstate Medical University. We'll hear with more on this is the new medical director for the emergency department, Dr. Jeremy Joslin. Thanks for coming in, Dr. Joslin.
Thanks for having me.
So we all know that it's difficult, it's frightening when you have a medical emergency and you need swift and excellent medical attention. What happens when someone comes to the emergency room at emergency department at Upstate Medical University?
Yeah, it certainly can be. For some people, it's the worst day of their life. We try to think of it as being in the business of organizing what might feel like chaos to the patient and try to help you through it. And so we pay particular attention to every part of our operation. If you come by ambulance or if you walk in the door, we have specific parts of our team that will meet you there, that will find out why you're there, and will sort out whether you need to be seen emergently or whether somebody else who might be arrived around the same time needs to be seen more urgently. So we'll sort that out. We'll get you back to a room as quickly as we can. And meanwhile, we'll be trying to get some information from you. We try to do things as much at the same time as possible. So we think of them as trying to do these types of operations in parallel versus in series. And so you might get greeted by somebody who's asking you about registration information, so your name and address. At the same time, you might have a nurse who's starting to get vital signs on you. So we try not to waste any time. We try to do as much as we can do at the same time in a team approach to try to get a handle on what's going on, get things organized, and try to give you some feedback on what's going on and what we anticipate that you'll need.
Is that what you would call triaging? That's an oftenly commonly used phrase.
Right. So some places think of triage as a location where you go. We prefer to think of it as a process. And so the process of triaging is to sort out what's going on.
And prioritizing. Right. Who needs help when, yep, and how quickly and all of that. Well, as a level one trauma center, you must have some other very, very significant challenges that come into play. Tell us about those.
We do. We're the level one trauma center for the region. And so we cover, I believe at last count, it was something like 19 counties where we provide the primary level one trauma coverage. And so it can be a challenge because we're constantly receiving patients from the north part of the state or the south part of the state at the same time that we're serving the city of Syracuse and the county. We're also serving the region. And so sometimes that can be a challenge to take care of so many patients at the same time.
What kinds of, when we say level one trauma center, for those listeners who don't understand what that means, help us understand who are those patients that you would be seeing?
So there is a little bit of technicalities that go into how you would create a level one or level two trauma center. But being the level one trauma center, we are the location where patients who've had a traumatic injury will end up for definitive care if a lower designated trauma center can't care for that type of injury.
So what kinds of trauma? Are we talking about motorcycle accidents, fire? I mean, what are the kinds of things we're talking
about? We really do get everything. Spine injuries, brain injuries, motor
gunshot
vehicle crashes,
wounds.
Penetrating trauma. Yeah, the serious end of trauma.
So anyone who sustained a serious traumatic injury of some kind would generally, in our region, come here?
Correct.
I see. So, you know, you've been working in the field a very long time, I know, and I won't say that long, but a long time. What have you seen in terms of the new challenges that seem to be emerging for emergency departments? And what comes to mind, in my mind, are things like, you know, some natural disasters we've had, you know, all kinds of things of that nature, tornadoes in our country, that kind of stuff. And most recently, some of the outbreaks for infectious diseases like Ebola or others. What are some of the challenges that have, you know, newer challenges that have come into play that you've had to rise to, and how has that changed the emergency department?
Yeah, I think our emergency department has done a fantastic job recently. The example that comes to mind is the enterovirus D68, and so that was our most recent challenge. Certainly, Ebola is on the horizon as a potential challenge, and as you mentioned, all of these types of epidemics or pandemics can provide a challenge to us because we're used to operating in an environment with a expected volume for a day or for the month, and these types of events cause surges for us, and so it can be a bit of a challenge for any industry to deal with a surge. When your volume of patients goes up by several percent or by 10, 20, 30%, that can create a challenge just because of the physical limitations of the space that we have and the providers that we have. But I think we've done fantastic at rising to those challenges. We've certainly overcome them most recently. And, you know, the people who work in the emergency department, from techs, nurses to physicians, are of that type of person that rise to that type of challenge and meet it head on. And I think that that's demonstrated time and time again for us.
But how about things like training and preparedness? I mean, you know, most recently with this, the new Ebola problem and the outbreak, the problem that occurred in Dallas in an emergency room where the patient who clearly had Ebola symptoms was turned away. I mean, has there been more of an effort to sharpen the point on certain kinds of intake information and that kind of thing?
Absolutely. And, you know, the first case is a needle in the haystack type of a phenomenon, but certainly it's at the forefront. If you've read the news that hospitals are doing drills and doing a lot of preparation work, we're certainly at the forefront of that type of preparation work and refining our processes and reviewing procedures and detailing things that we haven't had to think about before. But certainly we're doing all that in the background, and we do want it to in some way stay in the background as something that's, we want to provide that same front end great service on the front, but realize that in the background we are working pretty heavily on those types of things.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Jeremy Joslin. He's the new medical director of the emergency department at Upstate Medical University. What's your vision for how emergency medicine should continue to expand and grow beyond what it's currently doing?
I think we provide a good model of that already. So here at Upstate, we have multiple subspecialties in emergency medicine that other places don't provide. So we have an excellent toxicology service. We have hyperbarics. We have wilderness medicine. We have EMS. We have pediatrics. The list can go on and on. We have geriatrics now. And so those are the types of ways where emergency medicine can expand and expand in a way where we are the experts in certain subspecialties and the patients who present to our emergency department. And we really do try to improve that and expand on that as much as we can.
Help us understand when you say, you mentioned a whole string of things.
Yeah.
So let's go back over a couple of them. I mean, I understand that you've recently opened a geriatric emergency department, and I know there's a pediatric, so you're really specializing in different needs for different populations who may need emergency care. But when you talk about something like the hyperbarics or the wilderness, how does that, what kind of patients would be affected by that? How does that manifest itself in terms of care?
So, for example, the hyperbaric medicine might might be called on for a patient who has had a carbon monoxide poisoning. And we know that in certain types of patients like that, hyperbaric medicine can help treat them in a way that standard medicine can't. Another example for hyperbarics might be a dive injury. And so there's certainly an industry of diving around, and you can get the bends, and the treatment for that would be hyperbarics.
So this is specialty services that you would offer that in an emergency mm-hmm. that aren't found elsewhere.
Correct. Yeah, we really are, I think, a model and example for having these subspecialty emergency services available to the community. And I think we do it more of it. We do it better than anybody else in the region.
Now, with your new tenure here as the director, medical director, what types of changes do you envision that patients should expect to see?
Well, I would expect that patients can find comfort and a little bit of education so that they understand what's going on. That would be what I would wish for with patients who come here. Some of the challenges is that we've expanded our volume, and so if you do come, it might seem like a pretty busy day. We have a lot of busy days, that's one of the challenges is just being able to take care of that volume of patients. And I'd like to try to make it a little bit more comfortable for patients. So that's definitely on our agenda.
Tell me about your staffing. How are people trained, the physicians, the nurses? I mean, what's the emphasis?
Well, I can tell you from the physician's perspective, a medical student would go through undergrad. They would go through medical school for 4 years. They would have to apply for a residency training program in emergency medicine. And we were able to select the best of the candidates that apply for us. And then that residency is 3 years of training. So we have a residency training program here where we have a number of young doctors who are learning how to do emergency medicine. So this particular and specific problems that are inherent in emergency medicine might not be completely absorbed and learned during medical school. So this is the time where those young doctors get to learn emergency medicine and the intricacies of it.
What are the kinds of people, generally, in your experience, that choose to go into emergency medicine? What are their skill sets? I know these are sweeping generalizations.
Sure. Yeah, I think it's you've got to be able to handle a lot of different information and synthesize it on your feet. And so cognitive ability has to be there. You have to be able to use your hands, so have some technical skills. So being able to suture, intubate, those types of skills. And then the other thing is the ability to juggle what can seem like a lot going on at the same time.
And not forget any details.
Right, and be able to handle that and prioritize in real time. That multitasking is definitely a skill set that we look for.
It sounds like a great challenge to become a really good emergency department doctor. So as you take over the reins as the medical director of the emergency department at Upstate, what are some of your goals?
Yeah, my goals are to try, number one, is to try to just even do a better job than I think we're doing now with getting patients in a streamlined way. So believe it or not, there's a lot that goes on backstage. If you think of Disney World and all the stuff that goes on that you don't know about, there's a lot that goes on in the emergency department, and there's a lot of processes that we can streamline. That's part of my goal is to try to make things even better from the time you hit the door to the time where you're receiving care, streamline those processes. Certainly, I feel like physicians everywhere can do a better job at talking to the patient, keeping them informed of what's going on. These are the types of things that we're talking about at a national level with emergency departments and emergency physicians. But those are things that we can bring home here and improve on. And that's one of my goals.
It sounds to me like being informed and knowing what's going to happen to you in that kind of setting when you're nervous and you're anxious could be a crucial part of how you feel both there and after.
Absolutely. And that's something that we really key in on. We strive to provide that to patients. And certainly that's our expectation for our physicians, for our nurses, all of our staff, is to keep the patient informed, really from the time that they get there until the time that they leave. And even when you're leaving, informed of, this is what we did today. This is what you should be doing going forward. This is the type of follow-up that you should receive and try to seek out. And if you need any help, let us know.
Sounds wonderful. Thank you. It's always a pleasure to see you. My guest has been Dr. Jeremy Joslin. He's Assistant Professor of Emergency Medicine, and he's the new Medical Director of the Emergency Department at Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, this is Maureen Franklin, registered dietitian with this week's Healthy Eat segments. A new study led by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention looked at the relationship between the consumption of added sugars and cardiovascular disease. Participants were followed for 22 years, and the higher the level of calories from added sugar intake, the higher the risk of cardiovascular disease. For example, those consuming 25% or more of their calories from added sugars were reported at nearly double the risk of dying from cardiovascular disease. Participants getting 10 to 24.9% of their calories from added sugar were at 30% the risk. What does this mean? Well, we can look at it this way. Looking at a 2,000-calorie diet, if a person consumed 1.5 cans of regular soda, that would take them to the 10% level. What we see in the marketplace, this is generally considered a small size for a beverage. Soft drinks are reported to be the single largest source of added sugar in the American diet. Consumers need to be aware of their added sugar sources. Is it from soda? Or is it from that sweet tea, that cappuccino, that energy drink, or a fruit drink? If you do drink soda or other sugar-sweetened beverages, how often? How much? The American Heart Association recommends limiting sugar intake to 100 calories worth or 6 teaspoons for women, or 150 calories or 9 teaspoons for men. It's important to be aware of your typical intake. So if you think you are consuming these types of beverages, again, you can look at it, how much, how often, and start to make those small changes to improve your diet. This has been Maureen Franklin, registered dietitian, with your serving of Healthy Eats.
Next up, how epilepsy in the elderly can often be missed and create serious consequences. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Welcome back to HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen along with you. And it's time for our Healthy Monday tip for November 3rd. Benefits of stretching. The benefits of stretching are numerous. Heavily utilized in Pilates and yoga, stretching is widely supported today as a vital part of fitness. Here are 5 good reasons to stretch. 1. Stretching has been proven to increase circulation, increasing the blood flow and supply of nutrients to muscles and cartilage. This reduces muscle soreness after working out. The less sore your muscles are, the less painful it'll be to exercise, and the more comfortable your day-to-day life will be. 2. Stretching increases flexibility. As you age, your muscles gradually become shorter and tighter, reducing your overall flexibility. Increased flexibility allows you to exercise more safely and easily. 3. Stretching has been shown to effectively increase range of motion in joints. Better range of motion enables you to keep better balance. And better balance means you're less susceptible to falls and the resulting injuries, which is of particular importance as you age. 4. Stretching helps reduce stress. Stress causes your muscles to contract, becoming tense. Gentle stretching exercise relaxes tense muscles. Also, since stretching is an exercise, it has the same endorphin-boosting effects, improving your mood and the way you feel in general. And 5, stretching can help alleviate lower back pain. Since many muscles contribute to your posture, stretching these muscles has the ability to greatly reduce or eliminate lower back pain. Stretching has many benefits. You can live a more comfortable daily life, increase your flexibility, and alleviate stress and pain just by doing a few stretches before, after, or separate from your workout routine. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Epilepsy is the most common serious neurological disorder in the elderly after stroke and dementia. But it's often overlooked or even misdiagnosed. We'll hear with more on this as Dr. Rebecca O'Dwyer. She's a clinical instructor and an epilepsy fellow with the Department of Neurology at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. O'Dwyer. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me, Linda.
So let's begin by reminding our listeners, what exactly is a seizure and what is epilepsy?
Great. So a seizure is a clinical manifestation of abnormal and excessive electrical activity in the brain, in the set of neurons in the brain. So when these neurons start firing aberrantly, we see these clinical manifestations kind of on the outside.
And the clinical manifestations are, give me some examples.
So I think traditionally we all think of that person who's convulsing with jerking and shaking of the limbs, and that is by far the most dramatic manifestation that we see. But the brain is, the brain can manifest many different behaviors that are also seizures. So it can be something very subtle, like the inability to talk or just staring off. It could also be confusion, especially in the elderly. It can be just that they appear to be confused.
Yeah, well, we'll talk more about some of the symptoms and why that makes it harder to diagnose in the elderly. But the fact is, a seizure is some kind of, as you said, aberrant or unpredictable or not
correct
normal behavior in the brain.
Yes.
That kind of comes upon someone and then they react, and usually more moving their arms, their legs, jerking some kind
exactly
of behavior.
Exactly.
But how... You can have a seizure, but not necessarily have epilepsy.
Correct.
So explain the difference.
So everybody in their life is allowed one unprovoked seizure. And an unprovoked seizure is basically a seizure that usually has no precipitance, in the sense that there is no chronic underlying disorder. So let me give you an example. Sometimes when we have low sugar levels in our blood, we can have a seizure. Even if we're not diabetic. And that would be what we would consider a provoked seizure. And there's a reason why our brain is reacting to a condition in our body. That doesn't normally predispose us to developing epilepsy. To have epilepsy, you have to have two unprovoked seizures.
But the tendency to be diagnosed with epilepsy is that you might have repeated or periodic
exactly
unprovoked seizure activity.
Exactly.
And then you have that diagnosis that this is more of a disorder.
Exactly. That it's a chronic disease that develops over time.
So tell me about the incidence of seizures and epilepsy in the elderly. I mean, clearly it's the most common, as we said, after stroke and dementia. That means it must be happening a fair amount. How many people, or what's the percentage that you would estimate?
So most recent studies are estimating 1-2% of people of 65 or older actually have seizures and epilepsy.
Who did not have it before they reached that age?
Correct, yes. So when we think about epilepsy, often our perception, and I think this is the public and physicians alike, is that it's a disease and that presents itself younger in life, so in childhood or early adulthood. But actually, it has a bimodal distribution.
Bimodal means it can occur, there are big amounts that occur at an early age, and there seem to be large amounts now that are occurring at an older age.
Exactly. And we often overlook that people develop seizures later in life, in the elderly years.
And that seems to be the problem. That it's often overlooked, and we're going to get to why is it And also, I just want to, a sidebar here, is that the impact and the burden of this is going to only increase as our population ages.
Correct.
And so if it's little understood or little expected, it makes it even more problematic.
Yes. So I think if you look at the last census in 2010, roughly 13.7% of our population is 65 or older. And the prediction is by 2030, 19% of our 19% of our population will be 65 or older. There's a recent study from Finland that actually shows that childhood epilepsy is on the decline and epilepsy in the elderly is on the rise.
Wow. So why is it so hard to diagnose? We've been implying that there is something different about how it looks in old age, older age, than it does in childhood.
So I think this goes back to what I was talking about earlier, where our general perception of a seizure is that that patient convulsing on the floor, on the ground. But in the elderly, often the seizures manifest themselves in very subtle ways. And for instance, just last week, I saw a lady who, while she was having her seizure, she was talking, she stopped talking, she stared off. And then with her right hand, she started to dab the side of her mouth as if she was wiping her mouth with a napkin after eating. And this went on for about a minute. So as you can imagine, something very subtle. And sometimes we miss it, physicians and family members alike.
Also, is there some danger that it can, that is an importance of distinguishing it from potentially more serious diseases that it mimics? For example, there are other life-threatening diseases like cardiac arrhythmias that can look a little bit like some of these behaviors.
That's absolutely correct. So there is something that we call convulsive syncope. So it's not unusual that when somebody faints, towards the end of the faint, they can have some jerks. So it again, it kind of looks like the more quote-unquote traditional seizure. And it is important that when somebody loses consciousness, especially in the elderly, that they go see a cardiologist, because there could be some underlying harsh arrhythmia problem. The heart beating the regular way it should be.
So the point is, these symptoms that we see in the elderly could be caused by any number of things, but epilepsy is not often the one that they think of.
Correct.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with neurologist Dr. Rebecca O'Dwyer. We're talking about seizures in the elderly. So do we know what causes these seizures in the elderly?
So the recent studies have shown that over 50% of epilepsy is actually caused by strokes. So kind of a secondary manifestation of a stroke would then be a seizure that can then go on where the patient actually develops epilepsy. And I think after stroke, the next most common cause for epilepsy are tumors, metabolic disorders, and also neurodegenerative diseases. So actually 10% of all patients with Alzheimer's also have epilepsy.
Really?
Yeah.
I think that's a very little known fact.
Mm-hmm.
How about things, you know, the seniors are often falling and sometimes incur injury to their brain that maybe goes undiagnosed.
I think that's an excellent point. So often in the elderly, what for you or I would be just, you know, a fall and you hit your head and we get ourselves up and we walk on with our lives, often in the elderly who are on blood thinners can actually sustain a bleed to their brain. So it's called a subdural hemorrhage.
Subdural hematoma or
correct,
subdural hemorrhage.
Yes. And that is often associated with seizures as well.
So then after that, they can develop seizures. And then does it really become an ongoing disorder like epilepsy?
It can.
So how serious is this problem? I mean, what can it lead to? Is it life-threatening?
So there are certain instances where it can become life-threatening. I think there is one clinical condition that's called non-convulsive status epilepticus. So that's a long, big, wordy way of basically saying that the brain is seizing and is seizing continually.
And wow.
It's a medical emergency. Often in younger patients, they have what we call convulsive status epilepticus. And that is, again, where you physically see the person shaking, jerking.
So you know it's happening.
So you know it's happening. Unfortunately, with the elderly, they often present with just days of confusion, of getting lost, of maybe speaking in jumbled words, not making sense. And we know from studies that status epilepticus has a higher morbidity the older the patient is.
So people can really die from this if it's not diagnosed properly.
Correct.
So how do you diagnose it?
So it's a difficult disease to diagnose because unless we're capturing the brain waves of the patient as they are actively seizing, we don't really always see conclusive evidence that they have epilepsy or that they're having electrical seizures in their brain.
But it's done with the traditional EEG?
Correct.
Electroencephalography?
Electroencephalogram.
Right.
Yes. So what that basically does is we put small electrodes onto the scalp of the patient and we measure their brain waves.
And do they ever do an EKG as well to try to determine if there are problems with the heart that may be also at fault here?
They do. And I think part of the workup in an elderly patient where you suspect seizures, you should always send them also to a cardiologist and to get that EKG and to rule out any heart problems.
So once you've determined, if you've determined or you have a strong suspicion that this patient is experiencing some seizure disorder, some seizure activity, what are some of the options for treatment? What do you do?
So here's where we have some good news. So with the elderly, usually it's pharmacologically treated.
So medications.
Medications. And studies have shown that epilepsy in the elderly is much easier to treat.
So it's more responsive.
It's more responsive in comparison to younger people, which is good. There is an art to it, though, because we know, I think it's a general problem when you deal with elderly patients that they are on many, many different medications for many different things and their interactions. And so you have to be smart and you have to look at each patient individually and choose the right anti-epileptic for them.
So how does it affect, very briefly, their lifestyle and, you know, epilepsy, especially either whether it's diagnosed or not? How can it affect, I mean, obviously it could lead to continued issues of depression and all kinds
Correct.
Of things.
So there is actually a higher rate of depression amongst the elderly with epilepsy in comparison to people of their same age. And this
really?
Is a big problem. I think epilepsy at any age is an isolating disease. There are
Because you're never sure.
You're never sure when you're going to have your next seizure. And that's actually one other point. In younger people, they usually have an aura, and which is like a prodrome symptom. They know a seizure is coming. In the elderly, that's often missing. I think also the not being allowed to drive, this constant fear, when am I going to have one? And there's just certain lifestyle changes. You know, you can't ever take a shower again on your own. You can't work at a hearth on your own
so
for
all
safety.
There really needs to be a lot of support. And a therapeutic team approach is very, very important.
Correct.
Which you do offer, I guess.
Yes, so at Upstage, we now are offering a geriatric epilepsy clinic.
Yeah.
And it's to tie in all of these loose ends, because it really does need a team approach to make the person's life the most enjoyable that we can make it.
So bottom line is, we really think that both practitioners and family members or anyone who's involved with care of the elderly really needs to understand that epilepsy could be going on and a contributing factor.
Correct. Exactly.
Thank you so much for coming in. I appreciate it so much. Very enlightening. My guest has been Dr. Rebecca O'Dwyer. She's a clinical instructor and epilepsy fellow with the Department of Neurology at Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. How do we pass the time when we are ill and hoping for good news, good results, a miracle even? Minnesota poet Richard Solley shows us one method in his witty poem, Betting on Afternoon Light. For luck, some knock on wood, toss salt, hoping to nudge from the universe a random blessing. I depend on the mercy of numbers. I note addresses, count stars, trust the seventh hour of every day. Or examine a cluster, say my nurse's name, Sharon, the six letters, my sixth hospital stay, the 6 days God created the world, and me, the sixth child in my family, all omens, synchronicity. I gamble in a spiritual casino for grace while shuffling down the hospital corridor for surgical good fortune, the efficacy of a new pill. I believe an unfathomable mind works behind the scenes, intervenes through algebraic formulas, dividing or multiplying events. Like a mathematician, God answers prayers, subtracting one life, adding others to compensate. He blesses sevenfold after taking everything. In the Bible, someone is always counting years or cubits, oxen and concubines. I love the number zero. In it resides the moon, the sun, the day round as a clock. Zero appears twice, also good, in my hospital phone number, keeps me believing that the random acts of unkindness, accidents, and illnesses can be righted. True or not doesn't matter. I learn from illness nothing happens when I expect it to. Sunlight slants in now through the window at 45 degrees, and my pain subsides at 4:50 p.m. I know desperate men seek signs that they aren't alone. Help is coming. Afternoon light through the window tells me so.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we explore one local doctor's bout with dengue fever and how a new program is inspiring young doctors to return to practice in their rural communities. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLink on Air, all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Sirio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.